Greetings, friends. Welcome back to Critically Acclaimed, the film review podcast where good taste and bad taste, we have both of those things. My name is Whitney Seibold. I'm a film critic. A little bit of a frog in my throat this week, but none the worse for wear.
Mm.
And with me, as always, absorbing my germs, is sitting across from me, my scintillating, intelligent, toweringly intelligent co-host.
Uh-huh.
That's Whitney, you. Introduce
Whitney's
yourself.
Got a frog in his throat, and if I croak sometime this week, you'll know who to blame. Ribbit joke. Anyway, my name is William Bibbiani. I'm it's late, and
no,
I don't have any good jokes.
I'm the dad, and you're the one making the dad jokes.
Yeah, but I'm the funny uncle.
Oh, there. Well, you're the uncle.
There you go. Anyway, my name is William Bibbiani. I'm a critic. Everybody calls me Bibbs.
You're funny to someone, honey.
Thank you. We've yet to find the person, but they're out there somewhere. Someone laughed, and I just want you to know you're a friend to Bibbs is everywhere.
A friend of mine is a comedian, and he's, you know, likes to turn on occasionally,
sure.
Like when he's with company, he just turns on the joke machine.
Yeah, sure. You know, any excuse to do a bit.
He made a few jokes with a friend of his, and she didn't laugh at any of his jokes. Didn't laugh at it.
That means they're going to fall in love.
Well, and he asked, what's going on? Do you not find my jokes funny? And she very condescendingly said, you're funny to somebody.
Seriously, that's like the start of a rom-com.
That cuts deep.
That's the start of a rom-com. They'll find each other eventually. Anyway, this week on Critically Acclaimed, this is a podcast where we review movies. We are reviewing the new releases Ghostbusters Afterlife, King Richard, The Feast, Bad Luck Banging, or Loony Porn. That's all one movie. And The Christmas Switch 3, Romancing the Star.
Oh my god.
You are missing out on the Christmas Switch movies, man. Vanessa Hudgens is killing it every single year, and you're not even giving her a chance.
And she plays twins in each one, right?
Or
is she playing quadruplets by now?
Identical triplet cousins.
They're cousins, but they're identical.
Yes.
Okay, something weird's happening in that family.
Very weird. And we'll talk all about it at the end of the podcast when I review the Christmas Switch 3. Romancing the Star. Which is, not for nothing, one of the better heist movies Netflix has put out this year. And there have been a lot of them.
Well, there was Red Notice, and there was Army of the Dead, mm-hmm. and there was Army of Thieves, which was the best one I've seen.
Uh-huh. There was, what was it? Blood Red Sky?
Oh, I didn't see Blood Red Sky.
It was a heist. It was a heist in an airplane, and also there was a vampire on the airplane.
Okay.
And and now Christmas Switch 3.
Okay.
That's at least five.
I guess
I'm familiar with.
I guess we've unlocked Netflix, what they're into when it comes to escapist entertainments.
There you go. But anyway, let's start talking about a movie which it's the big release of the weekend. And it's one of those movies that was delayed over and over and over again because of the pandemic. I have seen trailers for this movie for like the last 2 years, and thank God it's finally out. Not necessarily because it's good, but because it's done. We can just
we don't need to think about it anymore.
We can stop talking about it like within a week or two, and whether you like it or not, I think we're all just happy to like, hey, we get to move on to something else we can watch trailers for. Let's talk about Ghostbusters Afterlife. This is the fourth feature film in the Ghostbusters franchise. This one is directed by Jason Reitman, Ivan Reitman's son.
The second film in the Ghost Core.
Oh, God.
This gets a... they put the Ghost Core logo at the beginning of this movie.
This would be like if when Lee Whannell released The Invisible Man, you know, that really great Invisible Man reboot, but if it had opened with a Dark Universe logo, and like, you'd be like,
still
trying to make that happen, huh?
Yep. It'll come back.
So in case...
It'll be on Quibi.
In case you missed it.
Yeah.
In 1984, there was a movie which had an all-star cast, but was still a bit of a gamble, called Ghostbusters. It starred Bill Murray, Dan Aykroyd, Harold Ramis,
Ernie Hudson, Sigourney
Weaver. Yeah, it's a great cast, undeniably. But it actually tried to take the sort of funny, shiftless layabout slob comedy genre, but combine it with the extraordinary. And they took science fiction, the idea that we've created these incredible new technologies that allow us to locate and also apprehend ghosts.
Mm-hmm.
But also we have a bunch of ghosts. So we have a bunch of supernatural fantasy stuff in it as well. It was kind of the perfect time for it because technology had just kind of caught up with movies, and something like Ghostbusters could actually look really cool instead of kind of dopey, which is what a lot of like the supernatural ghost comedies had until that point. So it's kind of a miracle that movie worked, because it's not only funny, it's actually like pretty smart. It's actually about things like entrepreneurialism and just how shitty New York can be. The idea is that New York is constantly overrun by some kind of pest or another, and right now it's the ghost of New York's past, which makes a lot of sense. It's a really good film. I like the original Ghostbusters a lot. It yielded two follow-ups. One was an animated series, which is very long-running, some of which was very good, and I think a lot of what people think of as the Ghostbusters mythology or lore or canon comes from that show, because we really only had that one other movie, Ghostbusters 2, for a long time, except for the animated series and its spinoff.
Ghostbusters 2 is 89.
Yeah.
Which, like, that was, like, one of the biggest summers in movie history.
It was huge.
Just because that had
Ghostbusters 2, Batman,
Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, one of the Star Trek sequels, I think, came out that year.
One of the Lethal Weapons as well.
No,
like, it was really huge.
Came out that... It was just blockbuster, a lot of sequels came out at that time.
Yeah, and Ghostbusters...
And, of course, the biggest film, UHF.
Of course.
Just got buried underneath all those other movies.
If you love it, you love it. Ghostbusters 2 is a film that I grew up really, really liking. It's a little repetitive to the original, but there's some really, really great ghost effects in there, like the Scolari brothers, like the ghosts of like the guys who were electrocuted.
Uh-huh.
Like you're in the electric chair. Those ghosts are scary. Those are some scary-ass ghosts in a vacuum.
Yeah, the second one is... The typical kind of Hollywood filmmaking, in that they just repeated every story beat. You can, like, transpose the first and the second.
They added a baby, but, like, they did that thing a lot of comedies do where, like, okay, took a whole movie to get the band together and prove that they're really good at things, and between movies, they broke apart.
Yeah.
Like, my favorite ones of those are when, like, in sports teams where they just said in the offseason they started to suck again, like in Major League 2 or the Mighty Ducks 2. Where it's just like,
oh, we just didn't train and we fell off our
game. And now we're just as bad as we ever were. And I'm like, I'm not sure that's exactly how that works.
That would have made more sense if there was like a lot of time in between the first and second Ghostbusters films. The curious thing about the Ghostbusters films, though, is Ghostbusters started to really deeply entrench itself in the popular consciousness in a way that a lighthearted comedy wouldn't, you would expect.
Mm-hmm.
It is a slob's comedy. It's about these dudes who are, you know, they're roping in ghosts with these magical lassos.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the day, they're just sort of these slobby exterminator guys in jumpsuits.
And in many respects, the first movie in particular is really made for adults. There's jokes about, hey, Luca, get down off this.
Do you want me to get the cat?
He's climbing up the screen door.
He's
Luca.
Like spider cat over. Here.
Honestly, oof, that's a new one. Don't like that.
Luca, get off the door.
Anyway, but the original Ghostbusters movie has a lot of stuff in it for adults. I saw it as a kid. A lot of the stuff went over my head. The idea that Dan Aykroyd has a dream about receiving oral sex from a ghost.
Yes, a sexy ghost, like, undoes his pants in one scene.
Yeah, the idea that this was, like, a family film is, again, I think only cemented by the animated series, which was, again, Luca?
He's got the rips.
Oh my god. Or the zoomies.
The zoomies, you call it. Yeah,
people call them the zoomies a lot.
Tears around the house for no reason.
He's just excited. But he just likes seeing
you. But yeah, it was a pretty crass movie, but a lot of kids saw it.
Had a lot of kid appeal, and I think the show really cemented that. There were action figures, really cemented that. There was a pretty good reboot series in the 90s called The Extreme Ghostbusters, which was about Egon teaching like a new class of Ghostbusters. It was okay. I almost saw some of it, but it wasn't bad.
But all of those years in between the release of Ghostbusters 2, and there was all this talk, they're going to do Ghostbusters 3. They never really did. And it became like a lot of popular culture from like the mid-80s. 84 in particular had a lot of films that people our age saw as children and began to venerate and canonize.
Like Gremlins is another one.
Gremlins. Back to the Future was the next year, but you know, Purple Rain came out in 84.
That whole era.
There's a lot of films that came out in the mid-80s that, again, guys our age tended to repeat and venerate really, really highly. To the point where it sort of rose in estimation beyond what it was, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
It's an impeccably crafted comedy. It's got great special effects.
The first one in particular,
I like that first Ghostbusters movie a lot.
I love that first Ghostbusters movie. I do not understand how it became a cultural touchstone.
Well, and how people became really kind of warm and nostalgic about it.
And weirdly,
when really it's
possessive about it, as though like a big part of your identity is that you like Ghostbusters. And if you grew up liking something, cool. I know a lot of people like that for Pokemon or X-Men or whatever.
These aren't like deep, rich characters to learn life lessons from. The whole point is that they're actually kind of assholes.
Especially in the movies.
Especially the Bill Murray character, Peter Venkman. So it was especially curious to see this weird kind of backlash, and there's been some controversy as to how much of that was actually manufactured and how much of it was organic. But when Paul Feig came out with a reboot of Ghostbusters,
I'm pretty sure they didn't want a lot of animosity connected to that movie. But Paul Feig was given an opportunity to reboot Ghostbusters. Yeah. And pretty much from the ground up, there were a lot of references to the original, a lot of cameos, mostly in a clunky way, but whatever. So Paul Feig rebooted it, and he did what Paul Feig does. Look at this movie Spy, which is very, very funny, but it's also kind of shabby in a lot of ways. It's a lot of set pieces, a lot of setups, and then you let your funny actors riff, and you kind of assemble it in the editing room. And that's how comedies were made for about a decade, decade and a half. Mm-hmm. Ghostbusters, the original films, were, you know, for all of their flaws, a little bit more structured than that.
They were a lot more tightly scripted. Yeah. They were based around the funny personalities. They were scripted by the original films by Dan Aykroyd and Harold Ramis.
Yeah.
And they knew that they had to sort of have a story and dialogue in place, even though they hired other comedians to sort of fill out the roles. Yeah.
Luca.
The Paul Feig film was a way too focused on that kind of riffing stuff, so there were a lot of just dead areas of that movie. I don't like that movie.
I like that movie fine.
It has nothing to do with nostalgia, and certainly nothing to do with misogyny. But
Luke. Okay, you need to get him down and close that door.
Okay.
Because he just wants to. What is your deal, bud?
He's possessed.
I don't know. Oh God. There is no Luca, only Zool.
He's possessed by Viggo the Carpathian.
I understand that there's some people who don't like that movie, and it seems to come from a weird, possessive, gatekeepy place. Yeah. It's also fair to say that the movie is a bit of a mess. I think the movie is a bit of a mess, but I mostly like it because, ultimately, I really like the characters in that one. In particular, Kate McKinnon's character of Holtzman is a character that I really identify with. I don't see a lot of introverted extroverts in cinema, and that's sort of who I am. Someone who is, ostensibly outgoing, but is actually deeply uncomfortable with a lot of various forms of human connection. And I really do think that character is a lot of fun. And I think that character is a nice kind of heroic version of that. A lot of people talk about like how cool it is to see themselves in a movie or how often they see themselves in a movie. And I almost never see myself in a movie.
Oh, golly, no.
So Kate McKinnon is one of the rare examples where I kind of did.
Okay.
And so seeing people say there are no good characters, and I'm like, well, that was me. So you don't like me, I guess. And so that kind of hurt. And
that's possible. People don't like me all the time. But
but anyway, there's stuff I really like in that movie. I think there's some good character work in that movie. I really like the ghost effects in that movie. I think they're actually kind of nifty. So there's a lot to enjoy there, but I get it if it's not your favorite.
I don't like the riffing. It's over-commercialized. I think they clearly, like, did weird things with, like, the color timing in that movie where they tried to, like, bump up the color and make it, like, extra saturated. And everybody looks unhealthy as a result.
Like, I think the ghosts look cool. I think maybe the skin tones were a little off, maybe.
There was a very strange reaction to that movie where, there were a lot of these fans of the original who felt like something was being violated in rebooting Ghostbusters.
And it really wasn't, man.
Nothing. You made a kind of a bad movie, but that doesn't offend me.
Honestly, it made a lot of sense to sort of approach Ghostbusters from an all-female perspective when you think about like the history of spiritualism and how that was very much a women's medium, no pun intended,
I guess, medium
for, you know, at the turn of the last century, and how there were so many gatekeeping men who tried to take that away from women. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, I thought that basically worked. Luca, would you mind getting off of the coffee table now? I'm going to pause this. We need to give this guy a little cuddle and make sure he knows he's loved. All right. The cat's been snuggled. The cat has been snuggled. All is well with the world. Anyway, we're pretty much caught up.
All is not quite well with the world because now we have another Ghostbusters film.
Yeah, I think it's worth noting that the last Ghostbusters movie actually made a decent amount of money. It just cost a ton.
Yeah.
And here what they've done is, okay, we're going to reboot this sucker. We're going to go back and make it a part of the original continuity, which the last one wasn't, to satisfy some of those diehard fans. Also, it's a little cheaper. It's a little less gigantic in scope.
This one takes place in a little tiny town in the middle of Canada, Oklahoma, and
Amblin-topia.
And yeah, this is very much taking a page from American Graffiti and other Amblin type of movies where everything's sort of small town 50s nostalgia, which is a very odd place to take Ghostbusters, which is very much of the 1980s. That is a Reagan era film.
Yeah, it's so weird to think of like how Ghostbusters was a story about a bunch of like men in their 30s, if not later, who are professionals and scientists who decide to start a business and brush up against like bureaucracy,
ancient deities, but also bureaucracy.
Yeah, and because so many children connected with it in the 80s, now that we're like trying to, you know, sequelize and reboot it today, the solution isn't to make it about another group of like older people who are like trying to start a business. The solution is to make it Stranger Things. The solution is to make it like every other 80s nostalgia riff. Make it more like Goonies. Make it more like Monster Squad. Make it more like E.T.
This bears less resemblance to Ghostbusters and more to Super 8, the J.J. Abrams film, which was just openly an homage to Steven Spielberg.
Yes.
So we have a younger generation. We have Harold Ramis, who passed away. Mm. His character, Egon, has grandchildren. His daughter, who's played by Carrie Coon, is really upset because Egon was an absentee father. He just was so obsessed with ghosts and sciences and the supernatural that he abandoned the family and moved out to this little town in the middle of nowhere for reasons that we'll find out later.
We never heard about this character.
Yeah, we don't know
Egon's other relationship. And she would have at least been born when the first two movies came out. So this is a pretty major retcon that Egon had kids.
That he had a kid that he wasn't paying attention to. And if she's not in it, then that comes into play. But she has two children herself. One is played by one of the Stranger Kids.
Finn Wolfhard.
And the other is played by an actress named McKenna Grace, who's really good in this movie.
McKenna Grace is good in everything. She's one of those child actors who I think very easily disappears into a lot of material. And I think some people would be genuinely surprised to realize how many times they've seen her in stuff. She played Judy Warren in the Conjuring movies.
Right.
She's really, really good, especially in Annabelle Comes Home. That's way more about her. She played the young Tanya Harding in I, Tanya.
Right.
She was in Amityville, The Awakening. I'm sure you saw that. Everyone saw that.
Which one did I see? I saw the one with Bella Thorne.
That was the one. I was kidding to the audience, but they were in Independence Day Resurgence. They were in the Angry Birds movie. They've been in a little bit of everything.
Egon has died in a ghost related incident, and he has now willed this big spooky house in the middle of Oklahoma to his daughter, who, as bad luck would have it, is being evicted that very day. So she has to move out to the middle of Oklahoma with her two kids. And the ghost of Egon, invisible, begins guiding the McKenna Grace character, his granddaughter, down to his lab and showing her that he's actually been trying to prevent the events from the original movie from recurring in this town in Oklahoma.
I love how much like people were like big on like spoilers. Like, oh, don't spoil anything in that movie. Literally the first shot in the movie is Egon's, there's like a one short scene. We don't see him. It's actually pretty tastefully done at the beginning. where Egon is driving away from the Ivo Shandor mining company. Yeah. Ivo Shandor is the guy who built the apartment complex Dana Barrett lived in, the original Ghostbusters, and he was trying to bring
the metals it was made from was like it was like a conductor for demonic energies, etc., etc.
So the idea that so basically all these plot points are pretty much revealed in the first shot of the movie, which kind of undermines all the secrecy that's been around the movie, but whatever. So yeah, Egon has been removed himself from New York, abandoned the other Ghostbusters in order to do something supernatural. There's a mystery that needs to be solved involving the events of the original film. And the ghost of Egon, which we never really see for most of the movie, but there's a lot of like really cute little bits, like Egon will like move a lamp in order to like suggest Egon's movement or paying attention. And
there's a really funny bit where McKenna Grace is looking over the proton pack.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, how did you build something this small? And the lamp swivels over to his wall of degrees. Oh, you're really smart. Of course.
And that's a cute bit. And honestly, if I'm being perfectly frank, you know, Harold Ramis is no longer with us. And that's very sad. Harold Ramis was, you know, not everything he did turned to gold, but he was a really brilliant comedian and directed some of everyone's favorite comedies. He directed Groundhog Day. He directed Caddyshack. A lot of people love Harold Ramis, myself included.
Oh.
And I actually think the idea of incorporating Harold Ramis as an unseen ghost kind of works for a little bit here. Because if you think about it, we're Ghostbusters. Mm. We know ghosts exist. We've proved that ghosts exist. If one of us died, why wouldn't we be a ghost? Why not? It makes perfect sense. So the fact that a lot of this movie is done with like Egon sort of playfully guiding their grandchildren into the family business is, you know, it's kind of like a necessity of the plot if they really want to incorporate Egon. But I actually think it's not badly done.
Until it is.
Until it is, yeah. Well, we can talk about that maybe in a minute.
And also Paul Rudd is in this movie, saving every scene he's in because he's Paul Rudd.
Yeah,
there's a single shot in this movie where Paul Rudd is in a Walmart, which, you know, clearly this is just product placement. Sony does this all the time.
Yeah.
And it's just a single shot of him walking down an aisle. He sees whatever it is he's coming to the store to get, and he kind of like breaks into this little like miniature skip with a smile on his face. It is the funniest scene in the movie.
He's just buying ice cream. Like, it's nothing.
It's like, yeah, it's crazy. It's like you're there with him in that moment.
I love that you zeroed in on how good Paul Rudd is in that scene, because the other thing, one of the things I zeroed in the movie is how otherwise terrible that scene is. He goes to a Walmart.
Uh-huh.
In the middle of the night, and now I know that some Walmarts are open all night or really late at night, but there's no one in it.
No.
There are no other customers. There's no one working there. There's no one else in the parking lot. And it just raises a lot of questions as to what does he not know it's not open and this is supposed to be some sort of mystery? Did they just get lazy and not hire enough actors that day? Like, there's a bunch of, like, little weird things that don't feel well thought out in this movie.
Yeah,
like, little things that just make the... That's one of the things that actually made the original Ghostbusters feel so effective, is that actually there's a lot of little details and touches that make it feel really lived in. Like, when the Ghostbusters would go to a hotel to, like, bust Slimer, they keep running into very incidental characters who just work there.
Oh.
And it just makes the world feel lived in, as opposed to just some set where they're going to show up.
I hate to say this, it's such a cliche, but it is a New York movie. It's about New Yorkers. I think the second one, like, was supposed to be about how New York is so full of negative energy that it's, like, coalescing into this physical substance.
Yeah.
But they don't really play that up in the movie. It's just sort of taken for granted.
Yeah.
None of that personality is here in this one. And in fact, all this film has is nostalgia imagery for the first.
Mm-hmm.
And there is so much machine fetish where the camera will just sort of like slowly pan over the proton pack.
Yeah.
And we'll see you'll see the light spinning inside. We're just sort of really like almost pornographically looking at this proton pack. Same thing with the car, which has been driven out to this town. And the
car is supposed to be a piece of crap. It was in the original movie. Like, the whole point is the car sucked.
It was already old.
Yeah.
And Finn Wolfhard is here, you know, fixing up the car, and he's going to have a joyriding sequence, and there's like new gadgets inside of it. And of course, we're going to have the lassoing the ghosts any minute. And of course, there's a very Slimer-like ghost.
It's weird that you really didn't have to make like the first ghost that they bust, like their test ghost, like the one, like their like first mission where they screw up a lot. You didn't have to make it look almost exactly like Slimer.
Yeah.
You did. You really didn't have to. Like, they really were, like, really just shoving it in there. And there's you brought up the whole bit about the sort of fetishization of the tech. And just before they bust the new Slimer, I think it's called Muncher in this one, they actually have a bit where they decide to test out the proton pack. And they're doing it like they're testing out Dad's shotgun.
A gun, yeah. They're, like, setting up jars on a log. Yeah. So
and we see them
off.
Again, they're not shooting anything at ghosts. They're just seeing what damage they can do. And so here we are, sort of making it seem, like, really cool that kids have high-powered weaponry, which just feels off. I get that Ghostbusters was always a bit, you know, a bit rebellious, you know, we're not really doing what the man wants us to do. But there's a difference between that and trying to sell kids on something kind of weird and gross. And that's one of the things that really frustrates me about this movie, is so much of this movie is about convincing these kids, specifically Finn Wolfhard and McKenna Grace, but also there's a kid played by Logan Kim who joins in here too. Yeah. There's a teenager played by Celeste O'Connor.
His name is Podcast.
He podcasts.
Celeste O'Connor, who has no personality.
Very little to do. But regardless, there's this young generation, and in the decades since Ghostbusters 1, which, according to this movie, is the only interesting Ghostbusters thing that ever happened. Like, there's a couple of things that are alluded to from Ghostbusters 2, like Ray owns that bookstore.
Yeah.
But they never specifically reference the events of Ghostbusters 2. So the idea is there was briefly a ghost thing, and then that was it. None of the other stories happened. The animated series never happened. Nothing. There was one event. And
when we get to this movie,
the idea that the only ghost thing that's going to happen is related to that one event again makes the world feel really tiny and small. Like, nothing else interesting could ever possibly happen that doesn't involve Gozer in some way. And that seems like a really wasted opportunity.
Yeah, that they're not just going back to the tech, but all of the exact same monsters, all of the exact same language, all of the
plot
points, references.
And then
if you wanted to see more with Evo Shandor.
There's way more mythos there too. But regardless, you know, the idea is Ghostbusters had a brief moment and then disappeared for decades, and now it's back. And now the children of the original Ghostbusters, you know, almost like Ivan Reitman's kid or something, are here, and the story that they're in is designed to convince a new generation that the Ghostbusters were super cool, were worth investing in, and we should probably make some more of these. Like, that's literally the plot of the movie, is to sell a younger generation on Ghostbusters. Which goes from, we like the original, we wanted to revisit it, and the characters, and the tech was fun, and there's a lot to enjoy here, and ends up making the movie feel really empty and shallow. Like, we have nostalgia, but it's nostalgia for stuff we want to sell you. Well, and there's something that just makes it feel not fun to me.
This was a part of the Ghostbusters universe that I feel like I kind of missed out on. I saw the original movie. Mm-hmm. I did watch some of the cartoon show.
Yeah, I watched a lot of the cartoon show.
I think the cartoon show was bigger than I kind of perceived at the time.
It was huge. And it was one of the highest rated TV shows on TV.
I didn't give a damn about the toys, so I didn't even look at the toys ever. And evidently, this was a huge cottage industry.
It was. There were a lot of fun toys for Ghostbusters. You'd get the proton packs and the traps. And
I remember there was a lot of
meat ghosts that would, like, mutate if you pressed a button.
I know there was a really bizarre line of toys where, it was the Ghostbusters, and their faces would extend in fear.
Like,
if you,
like, scared
faces,
like almost like a Spike Jonze cartoon.
That was really strange to me.
Spike Jones.
So this idea of making Ghostbusters into something super toyetic is also something that sort of grew in the decades since the original one. The idea that ghosts exist in the Ghostbusters universe and people sort of forgot about it, I think, is kind of a cute gag.
Yeah. It's a sort of thing that's weird, because, like, if you think about it, scientists prove ghosts were real.
Uh-huh.
But that didn't change the fabric of reality. And for a while there, I would have gone, that's totally implausible. But now we've got a whole movement that says vaccines are fake. And I'm like,
fair enough. Well, there's a whole thing where teenagers were learning that Titanic was a real ship. They didn't think that was a real ship for a second. They thought it was just something that happened in a fictional movie.
I never heard of that.
Yeah, that was a thing that was happening for a second. So the idea that you know, a giant marshmallow man stomped through New York and people just sort of eventually forgot about it is kind of cute.
Yeah, it's more plausible than I'd like it to be.
There is nothing funny about this movie. Mm. There's nothing exciting about this movie. Mm. The thrills are all grandfathered in from the previous film.
Mm-hmm.
I think the cast is trying to give it their all.
Carrie
Coon and Paul Rudd have a few wonderful scenes together. Because they start sort of having a romance. Finn Wolfhard doesn't do much of anything.
McKenna Grace is genuinely great. I wish they'd had a bit more solid a take on McKenna Grace's character, because I was watching this with Michelle, and Michelle is non-binary, and it's clear that they're trying to give McKenna Grace that kind of vibe.
Yeah,
like she's
female identified, but kind of androgynous.
Yeah, and watching the movie, I was like, what is it about that that just feels like they didn't nail it? And Michelle was pointing out that it feels like they wrote the character to be a boy, and then they just changed the name, and they kept a lot of the dialogue, even if it doesn't really track.
Okay.
And I think that really does hold up. There's a lot of weird stuff where, like, McKenna Grace's character has weird attitudes towards their mother, and it just doesn't really read from her character, but it'd make more sense coming from a stereotypical boy character.
Okay.
A lot of weird stuff like that. It just feels like almost there, but not quite. So I think McKenna Grace is actually doing some really good stuff with the character, but I don't think the material necessarily always supports them.
Yeah.
But again, I do think the cast is mostly really strong here. I actually think that there's a lot of pretty, like, effectively entertaining sequences in this. Like, I really like the there's one thing in this movie, for example, that I feel is actually, like, kind of good fan service, because we got to see something we never really got to see before, which is the Ecto-1 being used as a ghost-busting vehicle, as opposed to just a thing that delivers Ghostbusters to a place. It's got all that tech on top.
Yeah.
So let's see some of that tech in action. So there's, like, kind of a ghost-busting car chase. That bit's kind of fun. I had a good time with that. I certainly have nothing against that. That bit works fine.
The idea that we live in this world where the supernatural is real, and there's all these kinds of wild creatures, and we're just going to do the same ones again, is incredibly disappointing to me.
Same ones! It's literally
the same ones. It's all... It's, you know, this is a movie that is, like, made of just references stuck together with chewing gum.
Yeah. It's a real bummer.
And they have all of these fetishized moments where they're going to put on the jumpsuits, and they're going to use the ghost lassos again. They don't even alter it in any kind of interesting sort of way.
We didn't make it our own. Egon didn't, like, play with the tech in the interim, or, like, maybe make it better or cooler. And it all leads to, and I don't want to go into great detail here because it just came out and there's, like, some stuff, but it all leads to a big climax, which manages to be repetitive with Ghostbusters 1984. Repetitive with the beginning of the movie, like literally the first scene, we just do it again,
yeah.
Which is weird. And then manages to come together in this really fan servicey way that also manages to not work at all for me. And there's a lot of stuff I like in this movie. Like, this isn't like a complete wash for me, but it's absolute commitment to just retreading the old, to paying homage in, with the exception of a couple of fun bits or ideas here or there, really ham-fisted ways. And then just sort of like saying, like, here, you happy now? Here, I gave you this thing you asked for. And I'm like, yeah, I wanted it good. I don't know, like...
Well, given that Ghostbusters 2 is, we can debate its quality.
I didn't know people hated Ghostbusters 2.
Oh, yeah.
I thought Ghostbusters 2
has a pretty bad reputation.
It's weird for me. When I grew up, I saw Ghostbusters 2. I liked it when I was young. I didn't really know anyone who didn't care for it. I mean, I think we all agreed the original was better, but I didn't know who hated Ghostbusters 2. And the last, like, 10 years or so, I remember when Paul Feig's film came out, everyone's like, well, it's got to be better than Ghostbusters 2, right? And I'm like, whoa, when did we turn on Ghostbusters? Ghostbusters 2 isn't that bad. It's fine, right?
It's pretty bad.
I think it's perfectly
I don't like the Paul Feig movie, and I don't like this one either. Yeah. So I think we need to bury these ghosts. We need to put them under the ground. We need to... stop concerning ourselves with the sort of sacred canonization of the things we grew up with, because all we're doing is eating our own tails.
Yeah.
This is... The movie is like watching a snake eat its own tail.
It's funny. What was I just reviewing the other day? I was talking about the new Netflix Cowboy Bebop.
Uh-huh.
And it's so weird watching that show, which I didn't particularly care for. It's good casting, if nothing else. But it's so weird to watch that movie, It's so weird to watch that show, which feels like it's more inspired in many ways by Firefly than the original Cowboy Bebop. Which is weird, because Firefly was inspired by Cowboy Bebop. And the expression I used was, this feels like a tail eating its own snake now. Like, you're just being gobbled up by your own legacy. And I feel like it's almost what's happening here, where, like, we're so desperate to suggest a legacy for this thing that maybe it doesn't have. Maybe it just doesn't have the lasting appeal that those of us who were around when the real Ghostbusters was on TV...
Mm.
Maybe the level of affection and commitment on the part of the world at large just isn't as big as some people would like it to be.
Well, and
it did okay at the box office, but it wasn't huge.
There are some ideas, some stories, some properties that we keep going back to, even if the films are like repeatedly failures.
Yeah.
You know, Peter Pan is one that we keep coming back to. Robin Hood, for some reason. Yeah, I guess those are in the public domain.
Had good versions of both of those, but I feel the one I think of is Terminator.
Yeah, we keep coming back to Terminator. Terminator, the interest has waned completely.
Terminator 1 kicks ass. Terminator 2 kicks ass, even though in many respects it's basically just Terminator 1 all over again. And the problem with that movie is it's a repetitive story. By definition, it's about going back from the future to change the past over and over and over again. It's by definition repetitive. and every single time you do it, you negate some of the other movies by suggesting we need to do it again.
Yeah.
So even though it makes sense that these are big, giant, epic movies that made a lot of money, we want to keep making them, it actually doesn't make sense to keep doing so. Ironically, I think it makes sense in Ghostbusters, because the whole idea is... we catch ghosts for a living. Cool, you could catch all kinds of ghosts. Nope, just this one. What?
Just a certain very specific kind of ghost.
We're going to keep going to this exact thing. Oh,
There's no ideas of expanding the universe or exploring what the afterlife has to offer.
Even Ghostbusters 2 is basically like, we're going to kind of do the same thing again, except there's more slime now, and now it's a painting instead of a building. Oh, okay. all right. I think that's one of the reasons why when people think about this thing as a big franchise, they're thinking about the animated series, because the idea is every week a new ghost.
Yeah.
Why can't we do that as a movie? I don't know why we can't, but we're not. It makes no sense.
I hate that we keep on trying to leech money out of things that aren't working. We're trying to do it with Ghostbusters, and all we have is what we had before. All I'm seeing when I'm watching Ghostbusters Afterlife is their attempt to recreate a product.
Exactly.
I don't see a desperate need to revisit these characters because they're beloved or there's more to say about the characters.
Yeah, there's definitely an important story to tell.
In a little bit of an exposition dump, we learned what happened to the Ghostbusters. I liked that.
Yeah, it's fine.
What happened to these guys eventually.
Makes sense.
I do love they allude to the fact that Winston is just a billionaire now.
That's kind of fun.
I like that, because he was just like this grunt they hired like partway through their enterprise, and now he's a billionaire.
Good. He was able to ride
that into the world of finance.
Yeah, I feel like here's...
So I'm getting just gigantic whiffs of cynicism off of this thing, which makes it really difficult to enjoy even the things they're doing right.
The idea is that we're supposed to be celebrating this thing that we love, but you're right. It comes across as very mercenary. And ultimately, this is one of those movies where there's a post-credits scene in this movie. When I watch the post-credits scene, which first off, I don't think is done very well. But regardless... I'm watching this post-credit scene, which is clearly setting up future stuff.
Uh-huh.
And all I can think is, we could have skipped the whole movie and started here. Literally, that's all we needed. We didn't need this movie to get to that post-credit scene. They're completely unrelated in many ways, and you could just move on from there. And I think that's what they wanted to do. It makes the most sense. And at that point, maybe at that, like, once we get to that post-credit scene, maybe we can do something new. but we're not gonna. Nope. I don't think we are.
No.
I don't hate this movie, but I think there's a lot of things that don't work about it. I think it is, in some respects, superficially entertaining enough not to give like my lowest possible rating to. But boy, is this not like, oh good, finally Ghostbusters is back.
No, it's not a win. I wasn't filled with like a sense of fun or awe or adventure. It is aggressively plain and offensively derivative. This is not a film anybody needs to see. It should not have been made. We need to leave Ghostbusters alone.
It's a bit harsher than I'm willing to go, but I agree with the general sentiment.
Along with Peter Pan and Robin Hood and... One might even argue Harley Quinn. Harley Quinn's
doing okay. The comics do great. The TV show's doing well,
but she's been in four films, and apart from the first Suicide Squad, none have been big hits.
Admittedly, the last one was a pandemic release, so kind of a little slack.
Maybe so. I'm not going to pretend that any film has, you know, a hit. Deserves to be a hit as a birthright.
No, of course not. I 100% agree. I happen to think Harley Quinn's an interesting character, but we're getting into the weeds. Let's move on and talk about another major release this week. This, speaking of Suicide Squad, stars Will Smith as Richard Williams, the father of Venus Williams and Serena Williams, who became, in case you didn't know, two of the greatest sports stars in history. They're both like the top two tennis players in the world.
So
this is a story of how Richard Williams coached them and brought them up and like had a plan for their greatness, like knew before they were born that they were going to be big tennis stars, and fortunately for him, he was right.
He keeps on talking throughout the movie, he talks about how he did have a plan from their birth to turn them into tennis stars.
And a lot of people have plans from their kids before they're born, and they're not necessarily what the kids want.
And also,
so this kid got really bad.
And he says he has a plan, but we never hear what that plan is.
This is
part of the plan, and this isn't part of the plan, which he seems to sort of bring up whenever it's convenient.
I kept expecting to like go into like his work shed, and it's like a beautiful mine, like full of like strings.
Yeah, like
and,
the like
step, really complicated.
Like 3 years, this step happens, and 3 more years, and this step. But like none of that.
We don't really get into that in specifics. Yeah,
and Richard Williams is depicted as being a. Very overbearing, he's very controlling, but in a very warm sort of way. He's actually beloved by his family, even if he's a little bit of a control freak. And he's not really well loved by his neighborhood or any of the professionals he deals with because he's the one who wants to be in control.
Yeah.
And
because he's looking out for his kids, and he isn't convinced that anyone else has his kids' best interests at heart.
Yeah, and he's suspicious of anything that anybody else might have to say about his kids. Whether it's positive or negative, he's the one who has to be in control of this. And this movie just sort of shows what a difficult struggle it was for Venus and Serena Williams to start in pretty impoverished and rise their way up, just sort of practicing on their own and dedicating themselves to the craft to the point where they became world champions.
The movie details in a lot of ways how there's a lot of gatekeeping in the world of tennis. If you don't come from a background where you can spend a lot of your childhood just dedicated to spending, like, you know, you ignoring school and just studying tennis your entire life, how it's almost impossible to make it. And in order to do that, you have to be really well off. And in order to get and find, like, a good coach, oftentimes you have to be white. They're pretty frank about, which I do appreciate.
Really open about the racism in tennis.
And how, like, this is an uphill battle for them, even with all of their talent. It's an extremely uphill battle under the best circumstances that they've got. And, you know, it's interesting because obviously it's a bit of a foregone conclusion. I'd be surprised if there's a lot of people who haven't at least heard the names of Venus and Serena Williams. I think... What's interesting to me is, considering how overbearing is a good word to describe Richard Williams, considering how overbearing he is, how controlling he is, I think almost any other movie would be tempted to use him to create a lot of conflict with the daughters, when it's actually ultimately just kind of a sweet underdog story about this guy whose plan worked. And how much his kids love him. And ultimately just that attitude of familial warmth is infectious.
What I found very curious, because Will Smith produced this, and this film was directed by Reynaldo Marcus Green, who did a really wonderful film called Monsters and Men.
I didn't see that one.
Yeah, that's a really good film. It's about, you know, police shootings. Will Smith has produced a lot of his projects, mm-hmm. and like Tom Cruise, he's sort of taken over as kind of the creative heart of a lot of these movies, even if he's not directing them or writing mm-hmm. them himself.
Yeah, it's clearly a Will Smith vehicle.
And he is very careful about the kinds of characters he wants to play, and many, many times now, Will Smith has played an overbearing father to a kind of doting child who is going along with their father's will, and whether or not the father is seemingly in the right or seems kind of overbearing in the moment will ultimately be proven correct about something.
After Earth.
After Earth is the prime example yeah. here, where he starred with his own son.
Yeah.
And it's about how he plays an emotionless man who has to be emotionless to fight monsters who feed on emotions and has to teach his kid to be the same way.
Yeah.
And he's right about that. It's not about his kid teaching him to come out of his shell.
Yeah. Moment. Which you'd think would at least be part of it.
Yeah.
You know, like, oh, but then as the child grows up, I learn a valuable lesson about them having their own identity. And here, like, the closest thing King Richard comes to that is when, like, Venus William tells him just like, hey, I'm ready to move faster in the plan than you are.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not about, like, them saying anything that goes against the plan. It's about them saying, I think your plan is so good we can move along more quickly.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is a sort of thing where it's like, okay, but that's weird.
And,
a little.
And Will Smith is playing this part very, very well. He's actually really disappearing into the role in a way I haven't seen him do before.
Yeah,
even when he's playing like Muhammad Ali, he's kind of doing a little bit of an impersonation. I think here he's actually like getting deep into this part.
I think it's easy to forget because it's been a while that Will Smith is actually a very good actor.
He's a very good actor. Yeah. But the types of roles are kind of betraying what he's trying to communicate to his audience. And mm-hmm. what he seems to be communicating is, I'm not as bad a dad as you might have heard in tabloids. It's difficult to watch something like King Richard, even though this is about Venus and Serena Williams, mm-hmm. and not see the super narrative about Will Smith
mm-hmm.
laid on top of it. So I feel yeah. like I'm watching two movies at the same time.
Yeah.
I like King Richard as the sort of underdog story.
Yeah, it's got a pluckiness to it.
It goes on a little too long, but...
Yeah, it doesn't need to be as long as it is, yeah.
But, you know, that's not so grievous a sin.
No, and I actually, even then, it's paced pretty well. It's got a decent sense of humor. The supporting cast gets a lot of fun things to do. I think John Bernthal is really good in this movie.
Yeah.
Anjanou Ellis plays the Serena and Venus Williams' mother, whose first name I didn't catch. I should look that up.
All right.
But I actually think Anjanou Ellis, she plays Orisine. She's great. She's been great forever. Anjanou Ellis, like, she's so damn talented. She was an undercover brother. She was in Ray. She was in The Help. I hope she gets more Oscar nominations. Everyone's talking about, oh, will Will Smith get an Oscar nomination? Anjanou Ellis, more so than Will Smith, I think,
yeah.
should be up for this because it's one of those thankless kind of biopic roles, but she nails every single scene she's in. She brings more to it than I think is on the page. She's really, really great in this.
And I appreciate that they sort of take him down a peg. Mm-hmm. The Williams are Jehovah's Witnesses, and their faith is a big part of this movie as well.
Yeah, not as big as you might think.
No, but it's, you know,
it's there,
a lot of like their religious practices come into mm-hmm. how they practice tennis, so mm-hmm. it's part of the movie. But yeah, like, watching this movie, I'm just watching the Will Smith story more than I'm watching the Richard Williams story or the Venus and Serena Williams story.
Yeah.
And that's incredibly distracting.
Mm-hmm.
And it feels like an apology that Will Smith is constantly making about what we know about him as a dad.
Yeah, I see your point about the super narrative. Okay. I really do.
And as such, they're going for this version of Richard Williams, which is actually forgiving Richard Williams of a lot of his bad behavior.
Yeah, there's a bit in the movie.
Yeah, there's a bit near the end of the movie where his wife brings up to him, remember when your long-lost son came to visit us?
Uh-huh.
Could we have seen that?
Yeah, there's a whole bit where he's talking about, I forgave you a lot of crap.
Richard Williams has, like, at least 10 children, and, you know, maybe more besides. Shortly after the events of this film, he actually divorced that woman and started dating somebody his daughter's age.
Oh, God. I didn't know that. Wow.
There's a lot of sketchy stuff going on with this guy.
Never take your history from a Hollywood biopic.
No.
Never.
So,
never take your history from a Hollywood biopic.
And because they're leaving out those details, you're beginning to sense an apologetic sort of tone coming from the movie itself.
It's interesting that Venus and Serena Williams were executive producers on this, and a lot of people are pointing, because some people have said, like, wouldn't it have been more interesting to tell a story that was just about them and not so laser-focused on their dad? And some people have argued that, well, Venus and Serena Williams wanted to make this one. Maybe their relationship with their dad is such that they thought this would be a nice story to tell.
Yeah.
And maybe from that perspective, great. But it sounds like there's a lot of nuance that we're missing here because we have that doting perspective. And
it's not a warts and all kind of movie.
No, this is a very, very, it's almost Disney-fied. If there wasn't for like,
it's a little bit rougher than that.
And
the first
act when they're like, they're in Compton and they're trying to like train, but they're training like in parks where a lot of like local criminal element is hanging out, and they're sort of leering at the kids, and Will Smith is trying to get them to stop, you know, engaging with his teenage daughters. And then that goes into a bit of a violent place briefly.
Wow.
You could remove that pretty easily. You would miss that part of their growing up experience, and maybe that would be to the story's detriment. But you're also removing a lot of the other stuff that doesn't make them, that doesn't make it look great either. And you would basically, you remove that bit and you got a Disney film here.
Yeah.
And it's totally a Disney film.
And it actually makes sense to include that though, because Venus and Serena Williams' stepsister was killed in a gang shooting.
Mm.
That's not in this movie.
No, it is not.
Like,
they're very selective about what's in here and what's not. They only want the stuff that's inspirational.
Yeah,
There's a bit in this movie because I actually was a little unfamiliar with this.
This is not like well-known details, but it's on record.
And again, if you follow tennis, you probably know this better than we do. But here's a little detail I didn't know, which is I knew that Venus Williams broke onto the professional circuit before Serena did. I knew that because that's just, I remember hearing about Venus Williams before I heard about Serena Williams. But it started off where he was training them both. They're only like a year apart. They were like training at the same time. They were both equally talented, but because they couldn't afford to pay a coach, they could only afford to pay to like get a coach for one of them.
Right.
So they went with Venus at the time. And there's a bit in the movie, and like throughout this whole time, Venus is rising to fame, and Serena is constantly proving herself off on the sidelines.
Yeah. Like she's winning a different trophy where nobody's watching.
Yeah, exactly. And she's amazing, but Venus is getting all of the attention. There's one bit in the movie where Richard Williams takes Serena aside and says, Venus is going to be the number one tennis player in the world. You're going to be the greatest tennis player in the world. And I knew that's going to happen, which is why I let Venus get all the coaching, because I knew you could take it. And I'm like, that is some sugarcoating right there, man. That is some serious sugarcoating.
A little bit of back-treading.
It really does. Like, I get it. If this is true, and again, you want to question everything about a movie like this, even if this is true, I get it. You're kind of backed into a corner. Only one thing was available, and a choice was made. It's a rough choice, I'm sure. Thankfully, it worked out. But man, just that level of rose-colored glasses on this.
Yeah, what I wanted to see was actually a little bit more of this movie, an extended timeline of this movie, where we got to see how Venus and Serena Williams relate to their father now that they're adults.
Yeah, now that they're on their own, they can control their own destiny. You know,
how did their relationship change over the years, or did it not change? Is that that's what this film seems to be implying? Is that he's just this great guy, and again, as an underdog sports movie, this works just fine.
Yeah, if you don't care about accuracy, if you don't care about like what perspective we're seeing, if you just take this movie at face value as what it's telling you, it's very well made.
It's
engaging. It's got a lot of energy to it. The cast is very, very strong. I kind of wish the color timing hadn't been so like dingy.
It's kind of like washed out.
I don't know why this is a popular like color timing aesthetic right now, but I wish we'd get over it because it just feels just kind of bland looking sometimes.
They're going for naturalness is why they keep on doing that.
If you look, go outside, the world has other colors in it. It's not, everything isn't beige. I don't understand. But like, regardless, and this is not just this movie, like Cowboy Bebop looks like this now. It's driving me up the wall. But beyond that, it's a very well made film. But it's just one of those biopics where you can just tell someone had an agenda here, whether it was Will Smith or the Williams family or whatever. They really wanted this to be told this very specific way, which is something that you may find yourself holding back how emotionally invested you want to get into it, because part of it feels a little false.
Yeah.
But as itself, it's a satisfying sports story.
Yeah, it,
so I'm a little torn. Yeah.
It's phony in that sports movie kind of way where everything comes down to the big game.
Yeah.
But I'm okay with that. That works in sports movies.
Yeah. Well, speaking of overbearing family, I saw a new Welsh horror movie.
Okay.
And filmed entirely in Welsh, too. The Welsh language.
Oh, nice.
It's called The Feast. And it takes place in the Welsh countryside, where a very well-to-do family, the father is in Parliament, the mother is, well, I guess
she's
just
the wife of someone in Parliament.
Yeah, basically, we actually don't know a lot about her, other than she grew up poor and now she's very rich. And they have two sons, one of whom is training for a triathlon, but seems mostly to just enjoy, like, fetishizing, like, shaving himself.
Okay.
Like, he's just like, I'm wearing black spandex, and that makes me feel hot. And then their youngest son is a teenager, and he plays rock music, hates his family, and likes eating shrooms. It takes place over the course of one day. They're about to have a dinner party that night, and they have hired a young girl from a local tavern to stop by and help them host three dinner guests for a three-course meal. Uh-oh. It really isn't a lot of work, if you think about it.
Three-course meal?
Three courses, that's, you have all day to do it.
A salad, an entree, and a dessert. That's
pretty
easy.
Pretty much,
yeah.
It's not super, and when you see the meal, it's like, okay, it's rabbit, all right, and it's like vegetable shish kebab. How much help do we need here?
It's a veggie skewer, just roast this.
Yeah, it's really not super
put
complicated.
On stick and roast, yeah.
It's really not complicated, so they bring this young woman in, and all is not well. This family is full of assholes. You find out that the guy in Parliament is at least somewhat corrupt. The older son, who's in the triathlon, is weird and creepy. And it turns out that this young woman is weird and creepy, too. She doesn't speak a lot. She gets really frightened by loud noises. She starts leaving phantom trails of mud around her, even though she looks like her hands are clean.
Oh, weird. Okay.
Yeah, it's like weird, you know, foreshadowing something odd is going, maybe something supernatural is happening here. And there's this general portent of this is all culminating. It's called The Feast, so we know it's going to build to dinner. It's probably not going to be good what happens at dinner. Probably something bad is going to happen at dinner. So anyway, that's the first hour of the movie.
Just setting up for the dinner.
Pretty much just setting up for the dinner. And then the dinner happens.
Well,
and
but you said there's mysterious things happening.
Yeah,
though.
But like it's not taking up as much space as you'd think. And I want to talk a little bit about the difference between slow and slow burn in a minute. Because okay. I think they're easy to get confused. It all builds to a climax. And the climax, maybe not in the way you'd expect, does lead to violence. There's at least two or three things in this movie that are genuinely grotesque.
Oh, I love genuinely
like,
grotesque.
Like watching them, you go like, oh, that's not a thing you should do to a human leg. That's not a thing. Any leg really probably shouldn't be. You shouldn't be doing that.
Get a little knife and spread your toes.
Oh God, I wish. This is worse. Yeah, it's pretty graphic. It's really gross stuff. And it does build to a genuinely creepy thing. The problem is that it's really backloaded. You know, in a slow burn movie, and I'm trying to think of like a really good example of a slow burn movie, like Ty West's House of the Devil.
Okay,
it's a really great slow burn movie. It's
you don't know something creepy doesn't happen until like at least halfway through that.
Yeah,
movie.
Well, nothing is confirmed to be creepy until halfway through the movie.
Right,
but it's
right.
A story of a young woman who needs money fast so she can move out and get an apartment on her own in college. And she agrees to a babysitting job, but when she gets there, She finds out, a lot of red flags here. First off, the parents are Mary Woronov and Tom Noonan, so already creepy. creepy people.
Something's effed here. Yeah. Yeah.
And they say, okay, so here's the deal. We don't have a kid. We actually have a mother who's extremely old, and we need to go out for the evening because there's a big eclipse tonight. Red flag, red flag, red flag.
We did go out on the eclipse.
Yeah, and we just need someone to be here with her. She probably won't even make a sound, and she'll probably sleep through the entire thing, but we can't leave her alone.
Uh-huh.
And Justin Donahue was like, no, but if you pay me a lot, sure. And so they leave her at the house, and she just starts wandering around the house, and the more she wanders around, the more we realize a lot of things aren't right here. A lot of things are weird. A lot of elements of the furniture make no sense. A lot of the... It doesn't track. And as the story goes on, we see more and more things that are wrong. Halfway through it, there's one shocking bit of violence that confirms that, yes, something really bad is happening here. And then we go back to it, waiting for the character to catch up.
But the character doesn't see that happen.
And then once they do, it all comes crashing together, and it's really, really exciting. That movie works really, really well. It's a great movie. Because although it's slow, and technically for a lot of the movie nothing happens, we're always getting a new piece of information.
Right.
Maybe it's not a big piece, but there's a new clue. There's something else. There's just something to tantalize that. It's never resting on its laurels like, yeah, 20 minutes ago we told you something creepy would happen, and just trust us. It's like, no, every 5 minutes or so something new, even if it's a little thing, happens. That's not the feast. Unfortunately, it feels like they do all the heavy lifting in the first act, and it's only about a 90-minute movie. The first 30 minutes, a lot of setup. Middle 30 minutes, do not need it. And then we cut to the feast, and things kind of come together in a way that may or may not be scary to you, but ultimately, it feels like a lot of time is wasted. Even the sort of explanation for what's going on, what may or may not be supernatural,
mm-hmm.
A part of me respects this movie for keeping it kind of vague.
Okay,
This idea that we know enough of what's happened to piece together that someone has done something wrong, like something like a rule has been broken supernaturally. Like,
okay,
there's some sort of local folklore.
Somebody walked under a ladder.
Something like that. Or like, oh, yeah, no, stay off the moors, that kind of thing. You know, like,
yeah.
But they never actually go into great detail about what that is. But the characters know what it is.
Yeah.
You know, so it'd be like, oh, you're never supposed to go up to the old Johnson place. So basically what happens is everything's creepy. And then like just in the third act, someone says, did you go to the Johnson place? Yeah, before the start of the movie. Oh, my fucking God. Like that kind of thing. But we never find out what happened at the Johnson place. That kind of thing. And you don't really need it. It's almost excitingly sparse.
That sort of thing can bring sort of an era, or an atmosphere of curse about a horror movie.
And I like the atmosphere of curse.
Something's been violated, and you brought it upon yourself.
And not going into great detail is almost kind of meta. It calls to attention the fact that we don't actually need to know what it is. We just need to know that something happened.
Right.
Someone woke the vampire. Someone pissed off the witch. Something. So I kind of appreciate that. But it's all at the end. You could have, like, parceled that off over the movie and kept my attention in the middle bit by, instead of just taking it all in the last, you just all the pacing's off in this movie.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's really frustrating because the pieces are there, but they're not like, they're just not laid out right. You know, it's like a three course, it's like a three course meal, but like the middle, the main course is really bland, and they say, we're not going to give you your dessert until you finished it. But by that point, your appetite's gone.
Right.
Okay. So it's like, okay, this is a great dessert, but you made me eat, like...
a dry steak.
A dry steak and, like, white rice. Like 8 cups of white rice, and now I'm just kind of done. I don't care that you've, like, got a great bananas Foster. Like, it's not really... Anyway, it's a bit of a bummer. It's not a total wash, but I don't really think it works.
Do you know if this was expanded from a short? Because it sounds like you're describing
a short. It does feel like a short. It feels like it'd be a really good short. There's like a good 30-minute short here, like a Tales from the Crypt episode or something.
Okay.
It's not quite that like punchy like a Tales from the Crypt episode, but it's got that vibe. It would have been a really, really good short. I don't think it was based on a short. I didn't see anything about it being based on a short. But yeah, it definitely would have been better at 30 or 45 minutes, I think.
Nah.
But anyway. I'm sorry,
it was a disappointment.
Bit of a bummer, but tell me about the most intriguingly titled film of the week. This is Bad Luck Banging, or Loony Porn.
Bad Luck Banging or Loony Porn is a Romanian film. It's from director Radu Jude, who previously did I Don't Care If We Go Down in History as Barbarians.
And, great title.
Radu Jude, this is the first film of his I've seen, but evidently he works a lot in the métier of criticizing authoritarian government as they're rising in Romania and other nations as well. And Bad Luck Banging or Loony Porn is about a middle school teacher who, and we see it rather explicitly right in the opening scene of the movie, has made a sex tape. She's made a sex tape with her husband. And after we see the sex tape, we then, and it's explicit, it's an X-rated sex tape, we then cut to her wandering the streets, having phone conversations about how this thing got online. Somebody leaked her sex tape. We don't really learn how it got online, but there it is. It's online, and now she is wandering around these really dingy-looking streets of Bucharest, just sort of doing her daily chores, occasionally taking calls, and fielding some really foul behavior from the people around her. It's not ever really made clear if people recognize her from her sex tape.
Right.
Or if she's just being badly treated by the men in the public.
Yeah.
And also the camera tends to focus a lot on these sort of gigantic wide shots of this really kind of incredibly boring looking dirty architecture in downtown Bucharest while we see her sort of wandering through the frame. It feels very realistic and ultimate-y through these portions.
Okay.
As she's just sort of wandering the streets, taking phone calls and talking about how she might lose her job as a teacher because it's gotten back to her bosses that she has a sex tape online.
Oh, God, yeah.
Then there's a middle portion where we cut away from the character.
Okay.
And it's just a series of little miniature vignettes, maybe about 30 seconds apiece, where we are given a glossary of terms that the director is trying to bring in thematically to the movie directly. Rather than just allude to it or have it done in story or dialogue, he
we're
just says,
shoving them right in the middle.
Here's just an alphabetic list of terms, and it
these
goes,
will all be important later.
And it all goes to these wider themes of just this sort of social chaos that's sort of risen up during during the pandemic, where we're all trying to sort of point blame at somebody, and we're all just sort of full of this pandemic wrath, and how that in Romania goes back to a history of kowtowing to authoritarian figures, and how, and this of course goes into this very modern way of how authoritarian figures now tend to operate, and this all comes to a head in the third portion of the movie, where we get to see the it's almost like a real-time meeting between her and the school board as to whether or not she's going to keep her job.
Right.
And they humiliate her. Oh. They show the video to everybody. So we get to see it again while she's sitting there.
Jesus.
Full, like, kind of simultaneously resigned and full of rage.
Yeah.
About what's going on. And the conversation that goes on is, we don't want the kids going into this, but then these sort of like free-floating racist associations start to come up, and we get to see kind of the way modern discourse seems to operate now. And it's not long before she is being accused of teaching Jewish conspiracy theories to the kids by some anti-Semitic dick.
Oh my God.
And all of this is punctuated because this was filmed during the pandemic. There's all these shots of people like reminding each other to sort of like pull their masks up over their nose. And
yeah.
It's just like, everybody's just so annoyed by everything that's happening here. And by the time we get to the end of this, we get to see her defend herself. We get to see her teaching philosophy and how all of these parents are all concerned about these vague different things and this weird sort of free association that all, when cobbled together, resembles fascism without any kind of organizational thrust whatsoever. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting view of fascism, isn't it?
Yeah, that it emerges organically.
It emerges organically from
wanting
all of these little disparate things that have nothing to do with each other, but it's all people who are looking for some kind of scapegoat.
Every individual act of bigotry adds up.
Even if the bigotry is inspired by something else or is directed in a different group.
They seem unrelated. The concept of bigotry itself can take hold, and so it leads to this form of entitlement. Yeah.
There are three endings.
Ooh.
Very much like Clue. We get to see each one in succession.
That's interesting.
There's a happy ending, an unhappy ending, and a completely gonzo ending. And I want you to see this movie because that gonzo ending is pretty special.
Okay, don't ruin it.
I'll just say it's the gonzo ending.
Yeah.
This movie's fascinating. It's playing
Sounds
with
really
a,
interesting.
It's this weird sort of badminton match where we're examining a lot of Roma Edia's national character, the nature of fascism, and this unfortunate shame that we're still putting on sex.
Yes.
And a lot of this poor woman is accused, like they use the word slut a lot. They're trying to slut shame her. And she argues, I did that with my husband. We did it because it's fun. I didn't put it online.
Yeah.
My privacy was being violated here.
Yeah.
I don't need to apologize for any of this.
And, victim here.
And of course, there are all these like high and mighty purists who are like, oh no, I would never do that. This is completely unusual. Dan Savage pointed out recently that we're going to enter an era eventually, pretty soon, where every politician has a sex tape out there.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people do that. They like to take nude selfies or trade sex tapes with one another.
Or have some sort of sexual experience online in some way.
Yeah.
That could be discovered. Yeah. That's totally a thing. Yeah.
Everybody's going to have that because this is the way a lot of people sexually communicate now.
Yeah.
It's not relevant. I don't care.
Well, not necessarily relevant. It could be.
If somebody violates your privacy, that's relevant.
Well, there are also bad things that could be done. But generally speaking, if just having a sexual relationship with your spouse that involves something digital.
Two consenting adults want to photograph each other doing whatever they're doing. So long as it's legal, go for it.
Yeah.
That's not a problem.
Yeah, exactly. I agree with you on that. Well,
this kind of purist sex shaming.
Yeah.
Combined with this sort of free-floating hostility against educators and how it sort of springs up out of this really boring architecture in Bucharest is all being sort of directed by this middle portion where they're trying to come up with this glossary of terms for anything that might be alluding to fascistic ideas at large and sort of the unfortunate authoritarian streak in Romanian history.
Interesting.
I really dug this movie.
That sounds like a really interesting
film. Really
fascinating. I'm glad you saw it, but I'm mad I missed it. So I'll have to check that out. I'll try to check it out before the end of the year because that sounds really, really neat. I saw a Christmas movie.
Of course you did, darling.
What? Life is Hard.
Tell me about your Christmas
Life
movie.
Life is Hard. And I think I actually have been calling it the wrong title. I think I've been calling it The Christmas Switch this whole time. It's actually The Princess Switch.
Oh, excuse me. There is a movie called The Christmas Switch.
There is, actually. That's one of the reasons why I screwed it up. But also, they all take place at Christmas. I'll have to go back and check. But regardless, I'll just... If I mess it up, I'll just leave it in. My bad. The Princess Switch. Excuse me. Is a series of like romantic comedy type films on Netflix starring Vanessa Hudgens, who I must say is an absolute delight.
She always has been.
She's always had
kind of a movie star quality.
She's one of those actors who, like, I didn't see like their breakout. Weren't they in like the High School Musical?
High School Musical. I didn't
see those.
Okay.
So I missed like their breakout moment. And so I saw a lot of what they were trying to do to sort of like escape that, but I never actually got to see like peak Hudgens, and so this is peak Hudgens. This is good Hudgens.
Didn't you see High School Musical? Did we
watch
them together?
I missed that one. I never saw any of the High School Musicals. I hear they're fun.
The first musical is about how somebody might audition for a musical.
What?
Like the musical doesn't actually happen in High School Musical.
That's hilarious.
It's just about the audition.
That's amazing, and I love it. Sorry, Vanessa Hudgens in the original movie, and these are all still available on Netflix, the original Christmas Princess Switch.
Did it again.
Okay. Vanessa Hudgens plays a woman who owns a bakery. And she's a very good baker.
Oh, it's always a bakery, isn't it?
Yeah, well, some...
Not always a bakery.
Sometimes it's a bed and breakfast. this woman, she owns a bakery, and she's been entered into a cooking competition in Europe. And all the greatest bakers in the world are going to make various delicious Yuletide treats at Christmas time in the fictional country of fictional Countrylusia.
Matobo.
Yeah, something. Not Britain. They all have British accents. It's basically Britain, but it's not Britain, we promise.
Got it. Okay.
While she is there, it's also like at Christmas time, the prince of this country is going to marry the princess of another country. And it turns out the princess looks exactly like Vanessa Hudgens' character, because they're both made by Vanessa Hudgens.
Okay.
They realize this when they accidentally, like, literally bump into each other. And they have a moment. And they piece together that at some point the princess's, like, aunt or something like that abandoned the royal family and moved to America, and now they're distant cousins. But DNA apparently works this way, you know, like every once in a while.
Got it, yeah.
Yeah. That's just their justification. They needed to explain it somehow. It's like not just a coincidence. DNA is involved, so it's fine. They agree to switch places.
Uh-huh.
Because it's a Prince and the Pauper thing. And the princess gets to live the life of like a regular person.
This is the
like,
first princess.
First switch, princess. Right. I'm just saying the backstory because there's a lot of backstory here. The princess gets to live like a normal person. Vanessa Hudgens' character gets to live like royalty for a little bit. Vanessa Hudgens actually ends up falling for the prince, whereas previously it was just an arranged marriage and there were no sparks there. So when all is said and done, the lie is revealed and everything like that, or at least I don't think it's publicly revealed. And then Vanessa Hudgens ends up marrying the prince.
Mm-hmm.
And the princess ends up dating Vanessa Hudgens' best friend.
Okay.
And then it's also
played by Vanessa Hudgens.
You'd think.
They're all played by, and the prince is played by Vanessa Hudgens.
In the Princess Switch 2, Vanessa Hudgens is like, the princess and Vanessa Hudgens' best friend, they've broken up, will they get together again? Yes. Saved you a lot of movie there. But also, it turns out they have another cousin who looks just like Vanessa Hudgens. And I keep waiting for them to just introduce Vanessa Hudgens. Just the actress.
Just playing herself.
That would be really, really funny. And I hope that's what they do for Princess Switch 4. But anyway.
And there will be a Princess Switch 4.
But this Vanessa Hudgens is like a 1960s Batman villain.
Oh, God.
She's like super vampy. She's got like long blonde hair, obviously a wig or whatever. She wears outrageous outfits. She's got sidekick henchmen. And what she decides to do is kidnap one of the royalties and take their place in order to take over the country in a coup d'etat. But she kidnaps the wrong one because the princesses, for fun, decided to princess switch again. So she ends up impersonating the wrong one. It's very fluffy. It's very light. A lot of like, oh, I didn't know you were you. And a lot of slamming doors. And honestly, these first two movies are breezy and charming and very silly, but they don't pretend that they're not.
Uh-huh.
And it all comes down to Vanessa Hudgens can carry a movie. That's all it is. Vanessa Hudgens can carry a movie.
Which I know she can.
She can. So, yeah. She this is the kind of stuff she does really, really well. She's playing it up. No one's expecting anyone to take this too seriously. She's very, very whimsical. She's very, very good at playing a character playing another character badly.
Okay.
So, like, you always know which one she is, even if she's pretending to be another one.
Sign of a good actor.
Sign of a good actor. Honestly, I'm very impressed. And honestly, I keep thinking when I've been watching the Princess Switch movie, especially once they introduced the villain in the second one, one of my great fantasies is to, like, executive produce, like, a reboot of the 1960s Batman TV show.
Mm-hmm.
Like, a live-action, half-hour Batman TV show.
Same costume as new cast.
Yeah, new cast to get, like, Adam Driver to play Batman. And then you get... And then every villain is played by someone else.
Adam Driver is Alfred.
Oh, he would... If he's game, fine. But anyway, my point is that it'd be funny to see him in the costume. I think he'd do the job, but whatever. You need someone famous to play every single Batman villain. And this might seem out of left field for some people. I want Vanessa Hudgens to play Catwoman. She'd be great. She'd be legitimately great.
Okay. I'm with you.
Yeah. This is all very whimsical and cute. The Princess Switch 3, which is the new one, which I'm reviewing now, is a heist movie.
You mentioned that earlier.
Yeah. And what's more, it's a heist movie on Netflix in which the centerpiece is a group of people have to infiltrate a once-in-a-year party held by an international criminal so that they can sneak into his vault and steal a priceless historical artifact, and while they're doing it, they have to distract him with a tango.
Which was in True Lies and also
Get Red Smart Notice.
And also Red Notice. Yeah,
it's Red Notice. Netflix did this last week. Literally last week Netflix did this.
Red Notice cost more to make than Dune.
Yeah. No.
Yeah, has a bigger budget.
What?
Yeah.
Jesus Christ. it does not show on screen. You would never know.
I'm sure it went to talent.
I'm sure it did, but my God. What is really funny is that the sequence in this movie, better than Red Notice. Well, it's funnier.
Red Notice is limpid bad, so yeah.
Well, regardless, it's like even the tango is better. Oh. Vanessa Hudgens actually did the work. So the plot of this one is it's another Christmas in fake country Lugia, and they have visiting for the Christmas a special emissary from the Vatican, and they have brought a priceless artifact, the Star of Peace, which is this unbelievably gaudy Christmas ornament.
God, okay.
And it gets promptly stolen.
Of course.
And they have to get it back because the last time that this thing got stolen for, like, a Christmas event was in, like, the 1600s. And they, like, excommunicated, like, the whole country or something.
Okay.
So they really got to get this damn thing back before anyone finds out. And the premise of the movie is, even in this fantasy country, all cops are bad. So they literally just say, okay, so they stole this thing. The police have no leads. I guess it's up to two princesses to solve the crime. And in order to do this, we need someone who thinks like a criminal. So we have to bust out the evil Vanessa Hudgens from her community service, which we had mitigated to community service because we're corrupt. And so they get her out on this like 48 hours kind of pass. And the whole plan is, okay, we know it's this one guy. Why do we know it's this one guy? Because we're not going to waste any time on an investigation. It's this guy, and now we're going to have to like practice breaking into the place, and then we're going to have to break into the place, and then I'm going to have to impersonate you, and you're going to impersonate me, and I'm going to have to impersonate you at your parole hearing, which is unbelievably corrupt, and then that's kind of it. It's a big mistaken identity heist movie rom-com. Because now the evil Vanessa Hudgens has, like, an ex-boyfriend who's going to, like, fall in love with her.
You're describing, like, a Parent Trap sequel.
Yeah!
Any, like, Disney Channel original movie from, like, the late 80s.
Yeah, and we covered all of, like, the Parent Trap sequels in our Patreon a year or two ago. And
some of them were okay.
Honestly, Parent Trap 3, pretty solid. 3 in particular.
Not great, but solid.
No, totally. Like it's a totally legit movie. Like, the cast is good. The plot works. Everything about it is fine. Barry Bostwick really brings it. He saves a lot of that film. But my point is this. You can do these silly sequels. You can do these... This is screwball comedy.
Yeah, yeah.
This is the kind of shit... Like, if Frank Capra were alive now, he would have to do this on Netflix because there's no market for it in, like, the mainstream theaters right now.
What would Lubitsch do? He would do the Princess Switch 3 is what he would do.
Well, he'd probably be working in TV, which is where a lot of the comedy is going. He'd be doing, like, the Ted Lasso kind of route. But in any case... This is cute. It's not as good as the first two. It's not as funny as the first two. But this is breezy and silly.
This isn't grading it on the Hallmark movies curve, is it?
No. I'm not going to... It's not as... Hallmark is a much lower curve than that because they're just cheap and sincere. This has some money thrown at it. But it's not, like, great. If this was a theatrical release, I think it'd be graded on a bit of a harsher scale.
Yeah.
Because you always have to, like, factor in, is this worth finding parking? And maybe it's not. But at home on a Netflix scale, this is pretty good. This is pretty cute. I would say the first two are like legitimately charming, genuinely like 2.5 to 3 star Christmas rom-coms.
Uh-huh.
This one is more of like a 2.5 solid just because it just decides to be a heist movie and like kind of forgets it's anything else. And after a while, it's like, could this be Christmassy? And they're like, okay, they're drinking a candy cane margarita while they talk about heist stuff. And
it's,
I'm like,
it's called The Princess Switch. It doesn't have to be a Christmas movie.
Well, it is, though.
Princesses switching. That's all it's got.
But they chose it. They decided it should be, and the last two were. So we're doing it. I guess. Regardless. Anyway, it's cute. It's really cute, and if you like the first two, it's totally worth seeing. If you didn't like the first two, this is not going to sell you on it. And if you've never seen it before, watch the first two, and then decide if you have a law of diminishing returns or if this is worth it for you. But regardless, I like that Vanessa Hudgens has her own Christmas identity-swapping princess franchise, and more power to her. She's really, really good in it, even to this day. So... bless her. Now, again, in the next one, you have to bring in Vanessa Hudgens playing herself. That's the twist-a-rooney. That's what you got to do.
How many roles can she play before she dies of exhaustion?
I want to see, like, eventually this is going to build to Kind Hearts and Coronets. Oh, there you go. She's playing like every character, family, but they all die. Yeah. Anyway, that is it for the new releases. Let's review some movies on the critically acclaimed scale once again, in case you're new or haven't got the gist of it yet. We review movies on a scale of C minus to C plus. The lowest grade you can get is a C minus. That's below average. A C is average. C minus is below average. C is mixed bag. Some good, some bad. Maybe they're not worth getting excited about one way or another. And then C plus is above average. That's everything from we just genuinely recommend it to the greatest movie of all time. On that note, the Princess Switch 3, Romancing the Star, terrible subtitle, has nothing to do with anything. Slightly higher, okay, there's like a C, and there's a C+. It's closer to C than C+, but it's definitely far from C-. I'm making this harder than it needs to be. It's a C.
I was about to say, that's a long way to go to say it's average.
It's a pleasant C. It's a pleasant C. If this is the type of movie that you like because you like ditzy Christmas rom-coms on Netflix, you might grade it more highly. But this is a pleasant C.
A pleasant C. That sounds like something you'd yell at a band leader. It's like, could you play Moon River? Pleasant C.
All right, Bad Luck Banging or Loony Porn?
Bad Luck Banging or Loony Porn is a C+. I think there's a lot of really interesting, harsh ideas in this one. This film will infuriate you, though, especially that third portion where this poor woman is being humiliated by all of these, like, idiot fascist parents.
Yeah.
Will make you want to throw stuff at the screen. But, you know, fury is a legit response to something that's trying to evoke fury.
They want you to do. Yeah,
I think it's really, 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 really good.
Neat.
I'm going to give it a C+.
Okay, cool. The Feast, the new Welsh horror movie, it's a high C-. There's clearly a lot of talent here, but I don't think it quite works, and that's a real bummer. Needed some development or something. Like, the script needed some tweaking, because there's definitely creepy stuff here, but it's kind of not worth it to get to it. King Richard. Where do you land on King Richard?
A C.
Okay.
I really like Will Smith's performance, and as you pointed out, like an underdog story, it functions very, very well. As like a legit biography, maybe not so much, because it's more about the dad and not about, you know, the stars.
Well,
that
it's
we
allowed
know.
To be about the dad. For me, what it boils down, I agree. This is a high C for me. I was entertained by it, but I don't think I'm gonna like carry it with me. It's more than 2 hours long, but it doesn't feel it. It actually like is like pretty brisk. The performances are all very, very good. But you're right. As like a Disney underdog story, this is rock solid. But as a biopic, it's not that it's about him and instead of the Venus and Serena.
Uh-huh.
It's that it's about him, and it's so laudatory that it's suspect. And you can never quite get comfortable with it.
Yeah.
Because after a while, you're just like, I feel like we're letting this whole thing exists to let him off the hook. Rather than we just like the guy, despite his flaws.
Aww.
Feels like they just want to breeze over the flaws in a way that doesn't feel genuine. Hard. It's hard to really celebrate that, because it leaves the movie, as effective as it is on its own, feeling just a little false. And it never feels complete as a result.
Yeah, that phoniness is the thing that's keeping it from being a great film.
If it had owned its phoniness, as I said, it had gone the Cool Runnings route, maybe we could have settled for it. Yeah, but it never really does. It wants to be gritty while also removing most of the grit.
An unfortunate attempt. Yeah.
Yeah. And finally, Ghostbusters Afterlife.
Oh, big ol' C-. Okay. This is. Bland to the point of being completely insubstantial. I didn't like really watching it. I wanted to laugh or be thrilled at some of this, and there are a lot of details I enjoy about what went into the production, but this is just not a good or interesting film in any kind of measurable capacity.
I liked it more than you. I think on a surface level, there's some entertainment to be had here. I think some of the sequences are fun on their own, and I think we both agree that the cast is very, very solid here. I think I was kinder when I reviewed this when it like premiered at like a festival or a convention or something like that in October. And I reviewed it, and it was basically like a general positive on Rotten Tomatoes, but it was very, very mixed. And I think over time, I think the bad mostly outweighs the good, but I don't think it's terrible. So I'm going to give it a very low C.
Okay.
It's like, I think the entertainment value, and I think the cast elevates it above crap you don't need to watch. But I also think that there's so much about this that is just cynical and kind of misguided that it's genuinely hard to completely recommend it.
Yeah.
So it's like right on the edge for me. But I'll give it, since you gave it a C minus, I'll give it a slight C.
Okay.
Just because I think there is some entertainment value
here.
Anyway, that is it for Critically Acclaimed. We'll be back next week with a bunch of reviews. We'll be reviewing Resident Evil, Welcome to Raccoon City.
Which is Resident Evil 8?
It's a reboot, so it's kind of its own thing, I think it's the...
Seventh or eighth?
It'd be the seventh live... I think there's an animated one, so I think it's the eighth altogether.
Okay.
I think it's the seventh live action. Let's see, we've got House of Gucci is coming up. We have Holly Berry directing a movie called Bruised. We've got a Disney animated film called Encanto, and possibly more. I don't know. We'll see what's up. It's Thanksgiving week. We're spending a lot of it with our families. We'll fit in what we can.
That Gucci movie.
You saw the Gucci movie?
That Gucci movie's coming out.
Yeah. We'll talk about it next week.
Talk about that Gucci movie.
Oh, and also next week we were going to review Tick, Tick, Boom this week, but neither of us were able to get to it before we could start recording. So we will get to that next week because we both really wanted to watch that.
Yeah,
we'll talk about it next week.
There's actually a lot to talk about in that movie.
Yeah. So we'll get to that next week. Thank you everybody for listening. Thank you everybody for supporting the show. Please subscribe if you haven't already. If you want to join us on Patreon, it's patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. We have a lot of exclusive shows for you there. Shows we review every single episode of Star Trek, every episode of the 1960s Batman. We have commentary tracks. We have Patreon hangouts. Excuse me. A little dry in here. And more galore. So head on over to patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. Very special thank you to all of our patrons, without whom this show would not be possible, nor would any of our other shows be possible. So thank you. You mean the world to us. We appreciate all your support. If you want to join in the conversation, there's several ways to do that. You can follow us on Twitter at Critic Acclaim. I am at William Bibbiani.
Hi, I'm at Whitney Seibold.
You can also send us an email. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. We might read your email in an upcoming episode of our podcast, We've Got Mail, and answer your questions, respond to your critiques, give out recommendations, whatever you want us to do, basically. We're pretty open. We also have a P.O. Box if you want to send us snail mail.
Yeah, absolutely. Our P.O. Box is Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565. Los Angeles, California, 90064.
And also, it's the holidays, and it's also a big shopping season. And if you're looking for gift items, you might want to check out Salt Cat Soap. It's our Etsy store that I run with my partner, M. Lapis da Silva. We create and sell handcrafted soaps. We have a whole bunch of seasonal items. Excuse me. I need a drink of water. We have a whole bunch of seasonal items that are available. We also have a lot of evergreen stuff. Some of our Halloween stock is still available, including our very popular glow-in-the-dark ghost soap. It really glows in the dark. And we're having a Black Friday sale this week, so check it out. It's on Etsy. Look for Salt Cat Soap, all one word. You can also find the link on social media, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, at Salt Cat Soap, all one word. Again, thank you to everybody who's already bought some. Really appreciate it. The reviews have been really, really great so far. So we hope you enjoy it and consider us for your holiday needs. I think that's about it.
That is definitely about it.
Awesome sauce.
We'll see you next week.
Thank you so much. And until then, never forget, everyone's a critic.